Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello, welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Briley, here with you for Unbelievable. It's Saturday, it's 2:30 in the afternoon, it's Premier Christian Radio. That means it's the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together. And if you want to listen back to today's programme and many, many more besides, go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can find more resources, ways to get in contact, the links to the Facebook and Twitter account and all sorts of stuff there. And we're going to be hearing some of your feedback as well to last week's programme, Revisiting the Resurrection, towards the end of today's show. Unbelievable is the place where Christians and non-Christians come together for dialogue and debate. And I'm really pleased to say that on today's show, we've got two great guests and we're going to be doing a subject we haven't done in a little while. Let me tell you all about it.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, it's my great pleasure to have in studio with me Jonathan McClatchy and via Skype, Corey Markham. And today on the programme, we're asking, is God the best explanation for apparent design in nature? Yes, we're going back to an intelligent design debate today. Jonathan McClatchy, no stranger to that whatsoever. He's actually currently studying cell biology at a PhD level, and he's long been an advocate of intelligent design, the view that Darwinian evolution cannot account for the complexity in biology, and that design is the best explanation for many features we find in nature. Well, Corey Markham is new to the programme. He's an atheist and a blogger at the Atheist Republic website. He actually grew up in a Christian household, but abandoned any faith commitments as a teen, especially influenced by The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. You may have heard of that book at some point. But he studied philosophy. He's very much involved, actually, with the Facebook site as well. I'm staggered, actually, that Atheist Republic has over 1.2 million likes on Facebook, which is puts Unbelievable's meagre 6,000 likes on Facebook in the shade. So it's great to have you both on the programme today. Corey, he's been an avid listener to the programme, got in touch with me actually a few weeks ago saying he'd be open to just about any debate. And then Jonathan said he'd like to come on and talk about intelligent design. So I thought, why not get these two together and see what happens? So that's what we're doing on the programme today. So Jonathan and Corey, welcome along.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, I'm so happy to be here.
It's great to have you on. So, Corey, you've been listening to the show for a while. Can you remember kind of how you bumped into the show originally?
Sure. Well, I'd say for about a year or so, I've become somewhat obsessed with listening and watching debates online. I started out on YouTube, quickly started to eat up far too much data on my phone. and so I came along a couple of sites where they had the debates there in downloadable MP3 format. So I just started downloading and listening to debates like that. During that, I kind of came across episodes from Unbelievable more and more. Eventually, I actually found the website online, and really ever since, I've been listening to the show just about every single day. I've gone back. Actually, I've gone back. I think I'm probably back around 2008 now.
Wow.
I don't think I have any more episodes I can download on MP3, unfortunately. But
you're deep in the depths of the archive, then.
Absolutely, yeah, I love it. I go through, and if it tickles my fancy at all, I listen to it. So
you must be sick of the sound of my voice by this time, Corey.
Not at all. And as I was just telling you, so the listeners can know, I'm starstruck even being on the show because I listen to Justin every single day. And so it's just hearing his voice actually in person. It's surreal for me.
That's lovely to know, but also slightly bizarre for me to know. but it's thank you very much. In any case, Corey, as I mentioned, you're obviously an atheist, blogging at the Atheist Republic website. You've studied philosophy, though, and I mean, would you say that obviously the atheism you came to in your teen years has developed in any way as you've kind of poured yourself into studying and viewing the debates and so on?
Yes. Okay. So I don't know. I would say that I had a pretty typical American upbringing, which is to say that my family subscribed to a sort of, non-denominational Christian worldview, mm-hmm. Where the existence of God was assumed, and, you know, really the most basic tenets of Christianity. And I know that's a controversial sentence in itself, but some of the most basic ideas in Christianity, it was accepted in our home. Late in childhood and my early teenage years, however, I experienced a series of personal losses. A long, depressing story short, several of my loved ones and good friends were taken from me by things like cancer and, seemingly random car accidents. And essentially, these losses, they rocked me to my core. It really made me start to question many of the assumptions that I had taken for granted, you know, much of my life. The questions sort of picked up more and more mass as I went along. The more and more questions I had, the less satisfactory answers I could find. And then one day, it's an interesting story in itself, just this day. But one day I actually just sort of realized, you know, much to my surprise, that I no longer believed in God. And I want to stress too, it's a hard misconception. I come across it all the time. It wasn't a choice. You know, this was more like a realization. The universe had just almost like gone quiet, if you will, you know. And then sometime later, I kind of found myself more and more increasingly fascinated by the sort of questions that were being asked in philosophy and religious studies. And so, yeah, so here I am today.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that long story short, as you say. Perhaps one we could pick up on another day. But in any case, you're here and you've, you know, very bravely just sort of said, yeah, I'm up for a debate on intelligent design, because you're not claiming to be an expert on the technical aspects of this today, Corey, but you're certainly happy to kind of have a go at the kind of more the philosophical basis, if you like.
Absolutely.
And the questions around that. So I think we'll have a good discussion here today. Jonathan, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
It's great to have you. Nice to have you here in studio. And have you been interested in design and biology since your teens, pretty much?
No, actually, I began to become interested in intelligent design in 2007 or 8. I began my undergraduate program in forensic biology in 2007, and it was through my introduction to university-level biology, in particular the world of the cell and molecular biology and the wonders of DNA and the nanomachinery that governs the world of the cell, that I was awestruck by the engineering prowess of nanotechnology that just runs the show in biology. And frankly, I was often baffled at how anyone could go through a 4-year university program in biology and come out an atheist at the end, because the evidence seemed to me to be so clear and compelling. Just the information content and the DNA and RNA of the cell and what's required to produce new protein structures and that kind of thing, and how the proteins interact and cooperate to produce macromolecular machines. So that's basically how I became interested. And then I subsequently pursued postgraduate level study in evolutionary biology, and my interest has grown since then.
Yeah. I mean, in some circles, intelligent design is almost a dirty word in some scientific circles. Do you find that your views are countered frequently among your colleagues and so on?
Yeah, I do have my critics.
Funnily enough. But you do, nonetheless, you're convinced that their explanation is design is a good explanation for the features we find in biology and so on. You've been willing to defend that in various forums. And you're here today to do that again. I guess the big question is, as a Christian, do you see this as a valid sort of segment or piece of evidence for the Christian claims, more than just claims about design, if you like?
Sure. Intelligent design, I would argue, does not compel the truth of Christian theism, but I'd argue that it's part of the cumulative case for Christian theism. So intelligent design on its own doesn't get you so far as the Christian God exists, but it's certainly one element of the cumulative case, if you will, for theism and more broadly Christian theism.
And obviously it's not going to necessarily directly intersect with the issue that for Corey was the one that obviously it was significant in him losing what faith he did have, suffering. But as a cumulative case, as a positive evidence, you'd use it along with presumably other arguments for Christian theism.
I think it's very strong when coupled with other arguments, such as the cosmological argument and the fine-tuning and the moral argument and the ontological argument and so forth.
Yeah. Well, look, we look forward to hearing what you have to say and what Corey has to say, of course, in the course of the program. If we want to hear what you have to say as well, though, if you're listening and you'd like to get in touch, why not email unbelievable@premier.org.uk? And we try to read out as many comments as we can at the end of each program, of course. You can find us online, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. I'll make sure there are links there to both my guests and where you can find out more about their work. You can find, of course, links there as well to the Unbelievable Facebook page and our puny 6,000 followers. Hey, why not join us from Atheist Republic if that's where you're listening? You can find that again at the website, but facebook.com/unbelievablejb and @unbelievablejb for the Twitter if you want to follow me that way. So that's our subject today, intelligent design, and is God the best explanation for the apparent design in nature?
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Let's start doing some definitional work. I think it's important that we define what we mean when we use terms like creationism. There's young earth and old earth creationism, intelligent design, theistic evolution, and so on. Do you want to kind of spell out exactly what you mean by intelligent design, just so we're not confusing it with any of these other categories, Jonathan?
Intelligent design is the study of patterns in nature which bear the hallmarks of intelligent design and are best explained as the product of an intelligent agent. Intelligent design can be distinguished from creationism in that it doesn't flow from some religious premise. You don't need to accept the Bible to be an advocate for intelligent design. Creationism, by contrast, would argue that would try to interpret and understand nature in view of and in light of some particular religious text, whether that be Genesis 1 or something like that.
Mm. Are you kind of happy with that broad definition of intelligent design, Corey?
Yeah, I think that's a workable definition.
Okay. I mean, maybe the first place we should start then is why you believe there is evidence of design in the first place. Do you want to give us the general sketch of why, in all your studies of biology, Jonathan, you've really come to the strong conclusion that it does exhibit design, not even just apparent design, because I think even people like Richard Dawkins would say there's certainly a level of apparent design, but you believe it's more than just apparent, it really exists.
Living systems are chock full of digitally encoded information along the spine of the DNA molecule. There are letters associated with the DNA molecule. There's A, T, C, and G. And these characters are called nucleotides, specify the sequential arrangement of amino acids that form proteins. They do other things as well, but that's one job of the protein coding DNA. And there are different words along DNA that are called codons, and each of these codons is comprised of three different letters or nucleotides, if you will. And so you have this coding system, this codon to amino acid mapping, or is like a language, if you will. And so it's very, I think, beyond dispute that there is information in biology. Now, what do I mean by information? By information, I mean not merely Shannon information. Shannon information, as defined by Claude Shannon, who was a famous mathematician in the last century. Claude Shannon basically proposed that information correlates with reduced uncertainty. So as you reduce the uncertainty, you increase the Shannon information content.
Okay.
Whereas information, as intelligent design proponents would understand it, is Shannon information, but it's more than Shannon information. It's also what we would call specified complexity. Now, what do I mean by complexity? By complexity, I mean improbable, and I would say that for something to qualify as complex in the way that I'm using it here, it has to exhaust the probabilistic resources at one's disposal. And secondly, it must be specified. And by specification, I mean it conforms to some independently given pattern. So to take an example from our everyday experience, take an ATM machine. You put in your bank card and you have to dial a 4-digit number to get your PIN number, which will access your bank account and you can withdraw money from your account. Now, there's 10,000 possible ways of dialing in a 4-digit number to a 10-digit keypad, and that's 10 to the fourth power. And so, out of all these possibilities, there's only one number which will be sufficient to extract money from your account. So that's what I mean by specified complexity. It's more improbable than other combinations, but it's also confirmed as some independently given pattern, so it's special in that way.
And you see this all over the DNA that we find in living organisms. And for you, it's that alone, in a sense, is enough to say this wasn't a result of a kind of a blind process of evolution. There's not enough going on in evolution to produce this kind of complexity and specified complexity specifically.
Right. There's a habitual association between this type of information content and conscious activity. And so in every realm of experience, whether we find information in the form of a blueprint or a hieroglyphic inscription or a newspaper headline or the paragraphs of the book and so forth, every single time that we have experience of, it uniformly traces its source back to an intelligent agents. And so that's the gist of the design argument. It's predicated upon the historical abductive method of inferring to the best explanation for multiple competing hypotheses. And so it sits well within the bounds of scientific
inquiry. And so given that we make this perfectly valid inference to the best explanation of the design in all kinds of other areas, we're perfectly at liberty to do the same in this area, where we see the same kind of specified complexity that we might see in other areas of life.
Right, and indeed Charles Darwin actually based his theory on the principle of inferring to the best explanation, or the abductive method, if you will, as inspired from Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology. Charles Lyell was a very famous 19th century geologist, wrote Principles of Geology, which is a famous book in the history of science, which inspired Charles Darwin and forms the basis for the abductive historical method.
Right. Well, that's given us a really good grounding for those who maybe weren't familiar with what intelligent design is. So thank you for that. As I say, we're not going to get into the technical aspects of this today and start talking about RNA coding and this, that and the other, because I wouldn't be able to keep up properly with that. But Corey certainly wants to take issue with the question of whether we can infer design from these specific features of nature and so on. So where do you want to start with this, Corey? What would you like to do in this first section of the program?
I think I might start by, I don't know, I wanted to say maybe a few words about our human psychology.
Okay, go ahead.
And how I kind of think this, in the very least, I think we need to take note of it and be cautious and tread lightly, as they say, because our human psychology, if it predisposes us to seeing patterns in nature, and obviously we know this, and this is a good thing because we need to be able to perceive patterns to go about our way. And we also... We also seem to have this tendency to inferring purpose in our environment, and most importantly, we sometimes do this even when this isn't even when it's not appropriate, right? So, imagine you're one of our ancestors, right? You're walking along and a rock falls and hits you in the head. You don't know if it fell off the mountain, maybe it's just from the wind knocking it off, or if another individual of your group, say, or from an out-group, maybe threw that rock at you and actually tried to hit you in the head with that rock. Mm. The point is that you would have been better off inferring the latter as opposed to the former, mm-hmm. right? And so this is one of the, I think this is pretty I think it's pretty almost cliche now. I mean, we've all heard that the story of the Australopithecines or so on sitting there in the savannah, and they see the grass moving, and they infer that it's a lion as opposed to the wind. So I think this is a pretty well-known idea.
So the idea that those who were inclined to see agency survived, essentially, because
exactly.
it was a lion, they were the ones who had run away. And so so it's kind of inbuilt somehow for us to detect design and agency, even when it may not be there. Is what you're saying?
Yeah. Exactly. It's almost as though we've been sort of predisposed to erring on the side of agency in those sort of situations. And again, I mean, I can sort of foresee one thing that Jonathan might say to that, and it's obviously we do have good reason to trust these intuitions sometimes, right? And there are perfectly legitimate cases where we infer purpose and pattern, and it's real, right? So mm-hmm. this certainly isn't to say that there's no case where where this is a legitimate intuition on our part. It's just to say that I think we should really...
We need to be careful.
Do need to be careful. We often see shapes in the clouds, but sometimes they're just shapes in the clouds, right?
Sure. So I suspect you don't disagree that we should be careful of our biases in this area, Jonathan.
Right, and Corey's concern, I think, would be quite valid and legitimate if we were dealing simply with intuitions rather than a rigorously developed set of scientific principles for detecting and inferring design. I mean, I'd argue, for example, that forensic biology, which is what my bachelor's degree was in, is a science of design detection. Likewise, SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is a quest for detecting intelligence by virtue of patterns that they leave behind. And there's many times in the scientific endeavor when we are investigating intelligent agency. So there, if I was simply saying, well, it's my intuition that this was the product of design, then Corey's concern might be quite a valid one. But I'm not saying it's merely my intuition. I'm saying here's a set of principles for inferring design, and in every realm of experience of the cause and effect structure of the world, this type of cause or this one type of effect, this type of effect comes from one type of cause, namely intelligent causality.
Mm. Corey?
Yeah. Well, I guess perhaps you're not gonna grant me this at all, but I think on some level you have to admit that there's some gray area there. I mean, when we talk about inference to the best explanation, right? I mean, to a certain extent that's in the eye of the beholder, right? I mean, that best explanation or what you see as the best explanation clearly isn't what many other people see as the best explanation. So I don't think it's quite that simple. And so I guess what I'm saying is that move that inference that you make from this apparent design to an intelligent cause, I think that sort of move. That's the sort of situation where we need to be careful about these theological intuitions. And again, I grant it that I'm not that we do have to get much more specific with these issues, and that's why I only really meant to say that there initially as sort of a disclaimer, a caveat.
Sure. Well, let's move on. Maybe I mean, obviously, Jonathan feels he's on perfectly valid ground to see this as not merely an intuition, but something that is something we do elsewhere in science and so on. But what else are your primary concerns, you know, from a philosophical perspective on inferring design in nature, Corey?
Yeah, well, I think there are certainly some issues that, again, Jonathan is, I'm sure, is more than familiar with, and these are sort of the standard criticisms that are launched at intelligent design, especially in the context of whether or not intelligent design is a science. That's not per se really the point of this discussion. So I can maybe shelf those for the moment, and if we have time, we can sort of discuss that in a little bit. But I think my main issue is that let me just say this: like, my initial exposure and reaction to intelligent design over the course of the last 2 years or so, when it most really came into my radar, I have to admit, it very much was the sort of kind of a standard or typical reaction that you probably would expect, Jonathan and Justin, from atheists. It's just
creationism in a cheap tuxedo.
Exactly. Precisely. I mean, it just seems so obviously just creationism, relabeled in such a way as to make it seem scientific. And especially when you add into that the undeniable fact that there's what we're talking about today, right, is the issue, the science or the philosophical issue. Mm. But there's a second issue, which is basically the political aspect of this. Mm. And it's very unfortunate that political aspect has so much, especially in my country, right, because it tends to sort of poison the waters, if you will. And everyone in my country, it's hard to really address and consider intelligent design, you know.
Without that baggage. Yeah.
Exactly,
yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So when I actually, especially, you know, after speaking to you and finding out that we are going to be talking about this topic, I really started to get down and look into it more. And I got to say, I mean, there's much more to it than what I had initially thought.
Great. Well.
Absolutely. I mean,
Don't tell me you've converted to being intelligent design before on the program.
Not quite. And indeed, the second half of the episode, I think that's when we'll really get into... what I mean, what I will ultimately say, of course, is that I think that even if we do think that and make that sort of inference, I just don't see why on earth we would infer to a God, let alone the Christian God. But anyway, so that's a we'll leave that aside. And I think my main philosophical issue is just to say that we just don't understand certain aspects of biology, right? This is something that is going on in all fields of scientific inquiry. It's just that's just the way science works. I mean, I don't want to be too blunt, but I think ultimately what intelligent design, and I just want to talk about that in general, and then of course we can talk more specifically about say specified complexity, which Jonathan already brought up, and we can talk about irreducible complexity. But just in general, I think the intelligent design argument is either A, an argument from ignorance, which is to say, we don't know what's going on there, therefore design. I can explain it by this.
A god of the gaps kind of.
I mean, sure. I mean, or a mind of the gaps, if you will. You know, because they're a
designer of the gaps.
Yeah, and again, I think ultimately, I don't know. It's interesting because some of the intelligent design proponents, they seem to be kind of being sneaky here, and they seem to be quite obviously just talking about God, and they're just not saying that because they know that that's taboo, if you will. And then others, they seem to be a little bit more, you know, like, well, you know, I do believe in God, you know, but I'm just saying that this is evidence of design and it doesn't follow. And I, you know, I just make that sort of leap of faith. So saying that second thing is much different, right?
Let's allow Jonathan to respond then. I mean, it is a common objection to intelligent design. It's an argument from ignorance. Essentially, it's finding a gap that science hasn't yet explained and saying, therefore, a designer or God or mind or whatever it is. What do you say to those kinds of type of rebuttals, Jonathan?
The God of the gaps objection basically argues that intelligent design is rendered a placeholder for that which we are ignorant of. So we don't understand how feature X could have evolved, say, the bacterial flagellum, for example. And therefore, we just plug in God or an intelligent designer to fill in this gap in our ignorance. Whereas intelligent design really doesn't operate like that at all. It doesn't work that way. Intelligent design is inferring to the best explanation for multiple competing hypotheses and is, in fact, based upon the same standard principles of scientific reasoning as all historical sciences are. If, for example, you find, to give one illustration, if you're on an island and you discover volcanic ash, you favor the volcanic eruption hypothesis over the flood hypothesis and the earthquake hypothesis because in every realm of experience, volcanic ash comes from volcanic eruptions. So in a similar way, when we're dealing with information content in the cell, in every other realm of experience, information comes from an intelligent cause. Thus, when we're looking at the world of the cell and the information content there, I would suggest that the most causally adequate or the best explanation is that it too arose by virtue of an intelligent agent. You asked earlier, Corey, about my utilization of the phrase best explanation, and you said, well, this could be that this is kind of a subjective and isn't really something which is objective. I would define best explanation as most causally adequate explanation. So what types of causes are known to produce these types of effects? If you can show me a naturalistic mechanism which adequately explains what I'm attributing to intelligent design, then I will cease making this argument.
Let's continue the argument in a moment's time. We've come to our first break and we'll allow Corey to respond in a moment's time. We're talking about intelligent design on the program today, something we do every so often on Unbelievable. Today, it's a pleasure to be joined by Jonathan McClatchy in studio. He's a Christian currently studying cell biology at a PhD level, and he's interacting with Corey Markham, who's our atheist guest on the program today. So come back again in just a moment's time as we continue our discussion on whether God is the best explanation for the apparent design we see in nature.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
We talk affairs of the heart in the latest edition, following the hacking of Ashley Madison, the website dedicated to infidelity. Also, A Life Less Ordinary. Rachel and Andrew Wilson share their experience parenting children with special needs and how to cope spiritually with the life you never expected. Plus, apps to get you reading scripture again, Bible scholar Tom Wright, comedian Paul Carenza, and much more.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. Unbelievable is the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate on all kinds of issues and subjects, philosophy, history, the Bible, ethics. Today, science and God, something we do quite a lot on Unbelievable. Returning to that old issue of intelligent design, and my guests today, Jonathan McClatchy and Corey Markham, on both sides of this debate. Jonathan, a fairly well-known advocate these days of intelligent design. If you're not sure what that is, it's the view that Darwinian evolution cannot account for the complexity we see in biology, and that design is a valid explanation and the best explanation of the many features of the design we seem to see in nature. So Corey Markham, our atheist and blogger from the Atheist Republic website, has thrown his hat into the ring, as it were, and is going to give Jonathan as good a going as he can in terms of whether this all makes sense from a philosophical standpoint. If you've got an idea or something you'd like to say in regard to this topic, then why not email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I'd love to get your thoughts as well via the Twitter and Facebook accounts, facebook.com/unbelievablejb and @unbelievablejb for the Twitter account. All of those links available from today's show webpage as well, of course, where you can find today's programme and even leave a comment there too. So that's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Okay, Corey, we left off there with Jonathan just explaining that as far as he's concerned, it's not a subjective thing, this idea of it being the best explanation, that we do this elsewhere. It's a perfectly valid way of thinking about features we see all over the place. Why is it suddenly not allowed in this case, I suppose, is the question that comes out of that. Is there any reason why you think design shouldn't be on the table when it comes to features we see in biology and so on?
Again, I think I might surprise. I told Jonathan I was going to surprise him, so I really, really going to try to live up to that. But no, I mean, I certainly don't want to say that design is off the table. I mean, that would be in my that seems to be a very good point that's made by intelligent design proponents is there is this sort of I don't know, it's almost like this dogmatic approach to this issue where people don't even want to talk about it. Whether or not it should be taught in classrooms as science, right, with authority figures like teachers telling this to children is an entirely different question than whether or not we should, you know, actually be considering this and talking about it amongst ourselves and stuff. So, one thing I did have a question for Jonathan, but I wanted to make a point real quick because another point that I find really, really intriguing that intelligent design proponents make is this idea that there are other fields of science where we regularly infer a designer, mm-hmm. right, or an agent of some sort.
Yeah.
And so, like Jonathan, like you said, he has a degree in forensics, and I think one of the problems with making this analogy between these things is that, you know, first of all, we're presupposing an agent in the first place, right? So we're looking for that specifically, okay? And so it seems much more appropriate in my eyes when we do that and when we make those inferences to the best explanation, best explanation being an agent. But in biology, right, I mean, I don't really see that being appropriate. I don't see how I don't think Jonathan would say that either. That we should go about it presupposing an agent of some sort. And so again, it comes back to this. It may be subjective is the wrong word to use. Okay, but the point is that what Jonathan is looking at, okay, is the same thing that all the other scientists in the world are looking at, right? Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of scientists, especially biologists, disagree with Jonathan on a fundamental level about this issue. And that's just something we have to accept that. It's certainly not an appeal to authority. I mean, I'm not saying that they're right because they say that. Mm-hmm. But it's important that we get that elephant, recognize the elephant that's sitting in the room, right?
Yeah.
Jonathan, let me ask you a question real quick.
Can I just quickly respond to something there?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So the other disciplines that you mentioned, in particular forensics, where you argued that they are presupposing agency, that's not always the case. I mean, forensics can discriminate between arson and natural fires, or whether someone was murdered or whether they died of natural causes. So I'm not sure that's always the case that they're presupposing design necessarily.
Yeah. Okay. Well, fair point. So let me just ask you this. Would you grant that at the very least there are some biological systems in nature that are not designed, clearly designed, right? I mean, we haven't talked about a irreducibly complex yet, but would you at least grant that? Like, we can't just look at, like, everything that in nature, you know, cellular process, everything, we can't just look at it and say, oh yeah, that's quite obviously designed. Or what is that?
Yeah, so that's a fair question, I think. Do you think everything has the hallmarks of design, or are there some which have arisen by a naturalistic process, I suppose?
That's a great question. Thanks for bringing it up, Corey. I would say that that the design inference and the apparatus of design detection hopefully avoids false positives, but it is fraught with false negatives, where you might infer that something is not the product of design, even when it is the product of design, because intelligent agents are able to hide their tracks, as it were. And you can have things which look as if they're random but were in fact arranged by an intelligent agent. But I would argue that the intelligent design methodology is set up such that it avoids falsely inferring that something is designed, even though you might not infer that something is designed even when it is designed. So yes, there are things in nature which could have arisen by natural forces. But so that's basically what I'd say to that point.
I mean, are there any things in, as it were, living organisms or the aspects of the functionality of living organisms that could have arisen, as far as you see, by a naturalistic process? Or does, when it comes to the living world, let's say, do you think that because it's all predicated on that DNA molecule, it all therefore falls under the rubric of being intelligently designed?
Natural selection and random genetic mutation and other natural processes that we find in biology are causally adequate to explain some features of living systems. My contention is that they're not sufficient to explain all features of living systems, and I would argue even most features of living systems, and there's a good explanation can be found in intelligent design. Sure, there are some features which don't necessarily bear the hallmarks of design. But as I said, the design inference is fraught with false negatives, but hopefully not false positives. Mm. Corey?
I think that was a yes to my initial question, right? That, you know, would you grant that at the very least there are some biological systems in nature, you know, that are not evidently designed, right? Okay, so would you? Okay, so I was being a bit dishonest. I have two more questions, but they're all in order, and
Go ahead.
Okay, John, would you also grant that it's at least possible that there are some biological systems that, by our current understanding of them, they may seem evidently designed, like say the black bacteria flagellum. I'm sure that would be one you'd point at, but may in fact have perfectly natural explanations, whether or not we may ever be able to actually discover or discern such explanations. So would you also grant me that little point?
I would argue that intelligent design is the best explanation currently for what we find in biology, but I don't rule out the possibility that future discoveries could cause me to change my mind on that point. And I would say that's the same with any scientific hypothesis, that something might currently seem to be the case based upon the scientific evidence, but maybe 10 years down the road, we'll discover actually there's a better explanation for this particular phenomenon.
When it comes to the bacterial flagellum specifically, I know this has been a long debated issue, this supposed sort of what is often referred to as the outboard motor mm-hmm. of a bacteria. And it's been used by people like Michael Behe famously to make the case for irreducible complexity. And then others, like I think Ken Miller and others, have said, Michael, there are these other functions that they could have had in these intermediate processes that eventually got used as an outboard motor and so on. What's your actual take at this point on that debate, Jonathan? Do you think that the evidence is still on the side of intelligent design as a best explanation?
The bacterial flagellum actually happens to be one of my favorite macromolecular machines. I think it's a beautiful system. It's very diverse as well. There's not just one single bacterial flagellum, but there's many bacterial flagella across huge range of bacterial species. And I think that design is a good explanation for the origin of the bacterial flagellum. I do think that the critiques of the concept of irreducible complexity, specifically with reference to the bacterial flagellum, are particularly compelling. And I'm sure Corey can bring these up, and I'll respond to them in due course, I'm sure.
Corey, do you want to ask your third question, or do you want to?
Yeah,
keep going?
Awesome, you remembered. okay, so this is the point of what I was getting at. It it seems to me that the fact that there's any gray area here, however minuscule, all right, I think that that fact throws the whole notion of inferring intelligent design into question, right? Again, this is not a deductive process. This is an inductive process, okay? And I mean, how can we ever really know what's apparent design and what is really what's real design? I mean, isn't it always possible that, again, especially given the way our brains are finally calibrated to perceive purpose and agency, so we're already, we have our hands behind our back in that sense, to perceive purpose and agency when in our surroundings, even when it's not there. Isn't it possible that Jonathan, that you're fooling yourself and you're just seeing shapes in the clouds? I mean, you grant that it's possible that there are explanations, right? That we just don't know. And I guess my problem is that I don't see how you can really ever point to any particular instance in nature and say, yeah, there you go. There we have it. That's clear cut proof of design. It's always going to be this inductive process. And I don't know. That's not to say that it's false.
Okay.
I understand that, but
So there's always a niggling doubt that the design hypothesis might take second place to a naturalistic process that we discover that we didn't know before.
So let me ask you a question. So take the arguments for the proposition of common ancestry, for example. I'm sure you're probably familiar with these the Nessus hierarchical distributions, molecular variance patterns, and so forth, biogeography, etc.
I wouldn't distinguish necessarily between common ancestry and just, the general evolutionary understanding, but yeah, I okay. understand. That's an distinction. It seems to me that you intelligent design proponents seem to make more than others, but I very much may be wrong about that.
Very quickly, just on that point, I mean, I would distinguish between pattern and process. So there's a pattern, arguably, of common ancestry, and then there's a process which purports to explain that pattern. So you have the pattern versus process distinction. Evidence for common ancestry isn't necessarily evidence for neo-Darwinism. But coming back to the point about the argument from ignorance fallacy that you're accusing us of, take, for example, the arguments for common ancestry. Is it at least conceptually possible that in the future, 10 years down the road, that it will turn out that there are better explanations for those evidences than common ancestry?
Absolutely.
Right. So
it's
we're in the same boat.
Conceptually possible. I mean, but I would say that me saying that doesn't say much, like that would be a better question for a qualified
right.
biologist.
But certainly,
I mean, absolutely. You can turn this around. I will grant that.
So it cuts both ways. Is what we're saying, that question of you could be wrong, essentially.
Oh, absolutely, of course. I don't think anyone would deny that, that we could either side could be wrong.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not saying that I found proof of intelligent design. I'm 100% confident that intelligent design is correct. I'm saying that it seems to me that intelligent design is the most causally adequate explanation for what we find in biology, just as you might say that common ancestry is the most causally adequate explanation of the Nessus hierarchical distributions of mutations or what have you. And so it cuts both ways. So I'm not sure that...
Well, Jonathan, I mean, I don't mean this as sort of like an under the table move or something, but I mean, what do you say to all, I mean, the vast majority of scientists and biologists on this issue? I mean, they think that this inference you're making is just completely... completely incorrect. I mean, and that's just putting it politely, I think, right? I mean, it's not a conspiracy, obviously. I don't think you'd think that it's a conspiracy in the science, realm, but are you honestly saying that these people they're all wrong and they're just, they're not looking at the issue, in the correct manner? Or, I guess that's what I just don't understand. If I was in your position, I would just be, it would just be incredibly humbling, right? To take note of that fact. And I mean, the fact that you have a degree in evolutionary biology, right? And the fact that that itself was just hard for me to grasp. Like I remember I was telling my wife that, and she was hard for it to register in her brain, that I was like, yeah, he has a degree in evolutionary biology, but he doesn't believe in you know, and as what you call Darwinian evolution,
yeah,
you know.
In what is, yeah, the generally accepted paradigm across most of the scientific world. I mean, okay, Jonathan.
Being in the minority doesn't make one's position incorrect. And
I
I'm in the minority, but it's a growing minority. And in fact, I think there's far more support for intelligent design within the scientific community than you're probably aware of, because many of the scientific supporters for intelligent design are very quiet about their views, because as soon as they come out, they can face career difficulties. I happen to know several, even people with PhDs in paleontology, evolutionary biology, and things of that nature, who aren't public about their intelligent design affiliations because it would get them into career trouble. So I defend intelligent design on the merits and the basis of the arguments, without necessarily worrying about, you know, how many supporters do we have. All scientific revolutions start off with a minority that then grows and becomes the dominant position in the scientific community eventually, which I think intelligent design will come to be.
At one point, there weren't many evolutionists around, I suppose, is the point. But now it is.
That's what I was just going to ask. Yeah. So you honestly believe that there's a revolution happening, and that, you know, how long down the road do you envision this revolution happening, which I would argue that, again, the vast majority of scientists would just sort of scoff at. I mean, when do you envision this happening?
There is criticism of the neo-Darwinian paradigm in the mainstream scientific literature.
Do you mean to say that there are significant questions within evolution and biology that are being addressed, or do you mean that there are serious, legitimate criticism being launched against the neo-Darwinism? Are you saying that there's actual serious criticism being launched against that, like say in peer-reviewed journals, or what? Okay.
There are problems associated with the neo-Darwinian conception of evolution that scientists in the mainstream scientific literature will concede we just don't have a solution to. And these aren't just minor little window dressing type of issues. These are massive issues in evolutionary biology.
Okay, and so when they continue their work and try to understand it rather than inferring an intelligent cause, is that where you think they're getting off the tracks and they're not, you know, is that what?
Frankly, I think the vast, vast majority of biologists do not understand intelligent design, because every time I see intelligent design critiqued, almost all the time it's misrepresented or misunderstood. So the fact that biologists aren't necessarily coming to the intelligent design conclusion is often these things are influenced by one's worldview and the set of explanations that one considers to be feasible and permissible. You're familiar, for example, with Richard Lewontin, right? Who said that we cannot allow a divine foot in the door because the apparatus of science excludes a priori a theistic, or what he would describe as a theistic explanation.
I mean, this is a good point to move on to, because we should get to the issue of God as well. I mean, do you agree with, was it Lewontin?
Right.
Mm-hmm. In that sense, Corey, that you don't think a divine foot should be allowed in the door because theism just isn't on the table as an explanation in that sense?
Well, it's an interesting question, right? I mean, so Dawkins, that some people would argue that certain aspects of what you might call the God hypothesis, or maybe certain conceptions of God, could be tested in a scientific fashion, right? And in fact, some would argue that we are doing this, when they were studying the success of prayer, say something like that. So there are conceivable ways to test for the existence of a God. But I think the point is that there's no conceivable way to absolutely rule out scientifically that there's no God. There's no way to absolutely falsify, right?
Sure.
And so, as to this, just the basic idea in that you seem to see in mainstream science, this sort of presupposition of materialism and sort of the rejection of supernaturalism. I mean, that of course it's methodological naturalism is sort of, some would argue that's a key aspect of science, right? And there's some reasoning to that, but there's also some reasoning to some of the points that, again, that Jonathan and some of his proponents are making about the fact that science, by definition, is sort of an amorphous, constantly changing enterprise, right? So I would not say, in fact, and maybe this is one of the times I'm going to surprise you, Jonathan, I would not say that we should just absolutely rule out the existence of the supernatural, right? I would not say that. I would be extremely skeptical, though, about making that leap, and especially skeptical about making further leaps to specific religions and specific religious conceptions of theism.
I mean, so it sounds like you're saying, even if you granted design, it would be a big leap to go from that to a god, even bigger leap to go to a specific god revealed in a particular religion, and so on.
Absolutely.
I guess that's not what you're aiming to do with intelligent design, though, is my guess, Jonathan.
Well, intelligent design as a scientific theory, strictly speaking, is silent on the identity and nature of the designing intelligence, and strictly as far as the science goes. That's why we're very cautious as intelligent design advocates not to go further than what the scientific evidence tells us. Now, at a philosophical level, one can make these sorts of inferences and say, well, a theistic design seems to me to be the best explanation of this sort of phenomenon. But that goes beyond the scientific enterprise, which is, by the way, when one is dealing with issues of malevolent design or what is perceived to be suboptimal design, these issues, likewise, I would argue, go beyond the scientific enterprise because they bring up philosophical, metaphysical, theological issues. Science, as far as the science goes, intelligent design doesn't get you so far as theism, let alone Christian theism. But I would argue that when coupled with other arguments, then you can get as far as Christian theism.
I mean, you've obviously spent some time, you know, after not having looked at it for quite a while, Corey, looking at intelligent design. And from what you said at the outset, you were a little bit surprised to find there might have been more to it than I was led to believe. Obviously, you're by no means in any sense convinced at this point. You'd probably want to give a great deal more time and effort than you've been able to so far in investigating that. But is there a point at which you would be able to say, there's enough evidence here that I'm open to the idea of design in nature? Or is there kind of, in a sense, no amount of physical scientific evidence that Jonathan could bring to the table that would be enough to make you feel like that's a valid explanation?
Okay, so it's such a great question, right? I mean, sort of the cheap answer to, you know, what could change your mind is sort of the Lawrence Krauss answer, right? Well, if I looked up in the sky and I saw the stars arranged to say I exist or something like that, you know, that would be pretty. But I'm not going to say that. I mean, that would, even then, it's interesting if you think about it. I'm not sure that
in
that
a sense
should,
there's more.
I'm not sure that should convince us.
There's a better chance of that happening than the fine tuning of the universe. So at a level, you're kind of, you know, if he wasn't convinced by the fine tuning, why be convinced by something saying, dear Lawrence, I love you in the sky? But
you also might seriously start to question your sanity at that point too, and so that even then that wouldn't be a great clear cut. No, but I'm not sure what would convince me. But I can tell you this, that I there's nothing about my view that just absolutely precludes the idea of there being design. Okay. And this is kind of the point I kind of want to get at is here's the thing, though. I mean, it doesn't follow whatsoever that the designer is a god. I don't understand.
Right, sure.
Why would we jump to that? I mean, we would infer, I would think we would just infer some other, when I say other like-minded intelligence, I mean something else, some other sort of natural.
Yeah. I mean, Ridley Scott produced that kind of prequel to Alien, Prometheus, and that starts with these designers.
I'm such a huge fan of that movie. I really am.
And they kind of seed life on Earth. And
yeah.
Hey, that's the designer. Now, exactly. Jonathan, are you open to that kind of an explanation for design?
There seems to me to be approximately three different plausible candidates for designer. Let me just list those. I think you've got the extraterrestrial design hypothesis or the alien design hypothesis. Then there's the intrinsic teleology hypothesis. Maybe there's some sort of intrinsic teleology built into the world. And thirdly, there's the theistic design hypothesis. Maybe God is the designer. So these are the three explanations. If Corey has additional ones, I'd be interested in hearing them, but those are the only three that I've ever been able to think of. Now, the extraterrestrial design hypothesis and the intrinsic teleology hypothesis seem to me to be less preferable than a theistic design hypothesis for a number of reasons. For one thing, we have no independent reason to think that these other explanations are at least plausible, whereas I'd argue that we do have independent reason to think that the theistic design hypothesis is at least plausible. Now, even if you are not convinced, as I'm sure Corey is not, by the cosmological argument and the cosmic fine-tuning argument. The fact that there was a serious academic debate about those topics at least suggests that the theistic design hypothesis is at least plausible. Whereas we have no independent reason to take these other hypotheses seriously. Secondly,
apart from Ridley Scott producing a movie, but I know what you mean.
And secondly, the extraterrestrial design hypothesis and the intrinsic teleology hypothesis would presumably require some independent explanation for their existence, whereas the theistic design hypothesis does not require any external independent explanation because God, by definition, is a necessary being. And thirdly, I would argue that we have evidence of design not just at the origin of life, which might be compatible with some sort of extraterrestrial seeding of life by an intelligent agency from elsewhere in our universe, but we also have intelligent causality way downstream of that, at the Cambrian explosion, for example, and the appearance of these macromolecular machinery, which seems to me to be to really strain credulity to explain this as a product of aliens.
I don't see why would that be the case. So I mean, these would be think about that. You know, these are beings that the sort of the technological advancements that they've gone through and the technology they have would be far beyond anything that we could conceive of, right? So I don't see how you could just sit there and assume that, oh, well, I don't, you know, these are alien, the aliens wouldn't have the ability to go in, you know, into nature, sort of in the sense that you imagine, right? Except you seem to think that this is sort of a quasi-supernatural/natural process, which is, you know, a question in itself. I don't understand how that works, but I don't see why you're ruling out aliens apart from the fact that you obviously believe that it's God, right? And so I mean, and also the theistic hypothesis that as you called it. So I presume this what that means, that covers all conceptions of God, right? So that's just the idea that a God or gods of some sort created a universe. Is that correct?
Right.
Yep. Okay. Mm. Okay. So in other words, that third option, it's, you know, this could be Brahma, right, the Hindu god of creation. This could be Allah. This could be Yahweh / Jesus / the Holy Spirit, you know, or it could be gods that we've never heard of, okay. Right?
Well, I think that there is good reason to think that the Christian god Yahweh exists, but I don't claim to derive that from my intelligent design work. I think you can make a different case for that, but I wouldn't claim to derive that from this argument.
We're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll get Corey back in for the final part of today's discussion. Really interesting here, looking at the big picture case for intelligent design and whether we can infer a designer, a god specifically, from what we see in the evidence from biology. So my guests today are Corey Markham. He's one of the bloggers at Atheist Republic. Jonathan McClatchy is a Christian currently studying cell biology at PhD level, making the case for intelligent design. Here on the programme that aims to get you thinking every Saturday as part of Faith Explored Unbelievable. Come back in a few moments' time. Welcome back to the final part of today's Unbelievable. Don't forget that Unbelievable is part of Faith Explored. Every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio, we bring you a range of shows that aim to help you connect faith to everyday life, help you to think through your faith in different ways as well. It's brought to you in association with Premier Christianity Magazine. Our November edition is now available, and you can get yourself a free sample copy, if you live in the UK at least. PremierChristianity.com/freesample. Lots of interesting stuff. Our front cover feature on the Ashley Madison hacking affair. And affair being the appropriate word there, of course. Do check that out if you'd like to get yourself a free sample copy of the magazine. We're going to be hearing some of your feedback to recent editions of Unbelievable a little bit later on, once we've finished up with my guest today, Jonathan and Corey. If you want to listen to past programmes, of course, perhaps last week's where we were debating the resurrection, you can tune in via the website, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. Next week on the programme, we're going to be talking about the issue of suffering, and particularly whether God, if you like, orchestrates all kinds of suffering, or whether there's, if you like, a bit more of an open hand going on. We're going to be talking about the warfare model versus what's sometimes called the blueprint model of suffering. And we're going to be looking at that from two different theological perspectives next week. Quite relevant, actually, for where we kind of get to in today's show as well. So look out for more on that towards the end of today's programme. Right now, back to my guests, Jonathan and Corey.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So just as we conclude our conversation today, we've been looking at intelligent design and asking whether God is the best explanation for the apparent design in nature. Really interesting discussion between Jonathan McClatchy today, who is an advocate of intelligent design. Corey Markham, our atheist, has sort of thrown his hat into the ring here. It's not something he claims to be an expert in, but he's certainly been happy to research and draw up his own objections to intelligent design since I asked him to come on the programme. And so, Corey, we've covered a lot of ground this afternoon in terms of looking at whether, you know, we're being fooled by our natural susceptibility to look for agency in the world, whether this is an argument from ignorance, a God of the gaps type of argument. We've talked about whether you can get to a God from the intelligent design hypothesis. So we've done a lot of work already, but there's one more objection I think that you want to bring to the table before we have to start wrapping up. What is that?
Well, on the assumption that there is evidence of design, right? So we're inferring that there's a designer of some sort. It's an interesting question to ask, you know, what can we infer about this designer from its design, from the nature, from our environment and our surroundings? And I don't know. I don't think it's very flattering for the typical idea, that, especially the conception of God that Jonathan is purveying here. And Neil deGrasse Tyson, right? He's this astrophysicist. I'm sure you guys are familiar with him. He's normally very politically correct, and he's especially about religion and things like that. Well, there's this fantastic video on YouTube of him just going on a tirade of what he calls stupid design, right? And he talks about all these different aspects. I mean, he talks about fine tuning, and he talks about biology, and basically it's just different aspects about nature that seems to throw this whole idea of intelligent design makes it seem a bit silly. And some of the points about biology they're really interesting. And so first of all, think of all the genetic diseases, the genetic disorders that we have, right? So something like Huntington's disease. Okay, this is a 100% lethal condition. Where one's nerve cells in the brain gradually break down over time, say. Or muscular dystrophy is another one where, you know, certain genetic mutations, which, you know, I guess we would call these errors in coding, disrupt the normal production of proteins that's needed to form and maintain muscle mass. And if you're not familiar with this stuff, just please go online and look at this stuff. I mean, it's absolutely horrifying. And then some epidermis melasis bullosa, Jonathan, you might have to help me if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But this is an hair condition where the connective tissue, the skin, basically it doesn't have enough protein, the correct proteins in it. And so essentially the skin just falls off at the slightest touch. And this is a horrible condition. The children usually die of infection and horrible pain at a very young age. And I mean, there's other things too, right? I mean, so there are parasites that in nature, so tapeworms and mosquitoes. There are certain anatomical features about the body. So the fact that we can choke, right? Yeah. So we breathe and eat through the same mouth hole. And all the point being, there's all these different aspects of nature that I would argue, on the assumption that this is evidence of a designer, I would argue that this is evidence of what we might call a malevolent designer, either that or a stupid designer. And I don't know
a designer who didn't get everything right at the very least.
Either this is like an amateur. I mean, again, so and the question is, what's better? Does this make sense more on the hypothesis that these are alien, you know, these are extraterrestrial beings, or that this is an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God? Well, that's a no-brainer in my eyes.
Okay, that's a good place to start to wrap things up. So okay, great challenge there for you, Jonathan. What do you do with all the examples of apparently bad design in nature?
Right. So Corey has brought up the objection from malevolent design and the objection from suboptimal design or apparently suboptimal design. Now, it's first important to note that these are objections more to the theistic design hypothesis than to intelligent design per se. For example, you could conceive of a medieval torture rack. You know, it's designed, but it was designed for evil intent. So you could have intelligent design that's malevolent design. So it's more a critique of the theistic design hypothesis. On the, I'll come to that in a second. On the suboptimal design argument, it's interesting that you bring this up, Corey, because earlier you accused me of making an argument from ignorance, but it seems to me that the suboptimal design argument really is an argument from ignorance, because you know, it's possible that in the future we can discover reasons for this apparent suboptimal design. And I'd argue that there were many cases in the past where this has been the case.
So like epidermis epidermolysis bullosa. Like, that's, you know, where this kid is suffering. You think that, you know, that in the future that we'll find a good reason for that?
No, that's let me deal with the suboptimal design argument, and I'll come to the malevolent design argument. I think these are two separate issues. But on the suboptimal design argument, I think that, you know, this is an argument.
For instance, would that be what he mentioned about the your breathing apparatus and where you eat being the same place, giving rise to the possibility of choking? Seems like a
suboptimal. And the way our reproductive organs are situated right next to our waste facility. Yeah.
Sure. Or the inverse wiring of the retina and that kind of thing, or the recurrent laryngeal nerve and the giraffe and these sorts of things. Or the preponderance of so-called junk DNA. I would argue that in the past it seems to have been the case that many instances of so-called suboptimal design has turned out to have some function. Junk DNA would be one case in point, and so forth. And so that fills me with optimism that perhaps other cases will be likewise have other explanations in the future. So it seems to me to be a suboptimal design of the gaps argument, if you will, which has to retreat with advances in scientific knowledge. Now, as to the malevolent design argument, as of the suboptimal design argument, this goes beyond the scope of the intelligent design paradigm, but it is a valid critique of the theistic design hypothesis, which we're, of course, discussing in this program as well.
Right, because it could be aliens. So you're ruling that out. Right, okay.
I would argue that one. So I come from a Christian theistic worldview persuasion, as you know. And so the question that we have to ask is, well, does the Christian theistic worldview have adequate resources to tackle and explain this problem of apparently malevolent design, as you put it? I would argue that malevolent design in nature is a consequence of the fall. I think, you know, man is fallen. He fell in the Garden of Eden when Adam and Eve ate the forbidden fruit and they were banished from the Garden of Eden. And I would subscribe to the theodicy proposed by Bill Dembski in his book The End of Christianity. And I know Justin's had him on the program discussing that as well, where he basically argues that Adam and Eve were banished from the Garden of Eden into the world which God had prepared in anticipation for the fall. So just like the cross of Christ in Christian theology is retroactive with respect to its cause and effect relationship, so the fall is retroactive with respect to its cause and effect relationship. And you have two worlds that basically intersect at the Garden of Eden. You have the world as God intended in the Garden of Eden, and you have the world outside the Garden of Eden, which is the world into which Adam and Eve are banished when they eat the forbidden fruit and fall in the Garden of Eden. So God has no qualms about reminding us that we live in a fallen world. And so that, I think Christianity in particular has the resources to tackle this problem.
I mean, inevitably, but Corey, that's a theological answer to what is theological question that you're
explaining
asking.
Explaining away, you know, the so-called the butterfly boy. Maybe you guys were familiar with this. This story was in the Daily Mail, and it was talking about this child who had this epidermis melisa. The title of the article was a quote from his mom that said, "I can't cuddle my own child." Okay, this child, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if this child has already died. And the idea that this child's suffering, right? And again, I'm not trying to, because Jonathan needs time to respond to this, okay? But just the idea that somehow Adam and Eve, their transgressions, justifies and explains what I would argue the needless suffering of this show. That's just one of those ideas that doesn't work for me, you know.
Saying right at the outset of the program, which is obviously the reason why you've abandoned what faith you did have. We've kind of come full circle in a sense in that way. But Jonathan, I'm sure you agree that it's a terrible condition for a child to suffer from. But for you,
I just don't see how it's necessary. I mean, I don't.
Okay, Corey can't see it's necessary.
Why God didn't have to create epidermis? As you say,
this takes us well beyond the purview of intelligent design per se. This is broadening out into a theological debate at this point. But what's your response? Unnecessary, says Corey.
Well, I mean, would you grant that God could have made the world without epidermolysis bullosa?
Sure, he could have done.
That's all I need. I mean, that would be my point.
But the question, though, is what is the character and what are the attributes of God as described by the Bible? Because, of course, I'm representing a biblical worldview. If you want to debate in the future why Christianity is true, I'm happy to do that. But assuming the Christian worldview to be true.
Which parts of the Bible, you know?
Well, all of it.
all of it. Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Interesting. So I, as a Christian, believe that we live in a fallen world and that Adam and Eve were expelled from the Garden of Eden and that the world is suffering from a curse that is God's judgment as a consequence of our sin and our rebellion against God. So we don't just believe that God is a God of love. We also, as Christians, believe that God is a God of justice and of judgment. And there's a judgment that was placed upon the world at the point of the fall of man, which is the curse that we read about in Scripture.
Wouldn't that mean that, so in your view, the child suffering from epidermal, I don't mean to keep going back to this, right? But in your view, basically what you're saying is that is just, necessarily. Even though it seems awful to us, in reality, that's completely and perfectly justified. It's just, you know, that suffering. Well, you have to say that. I mean, I don't see how you could possibly say otherwise. You have to say that, because otherwise it means your God doesn't exist, or it's not the sort of God that you envision.
Even animal suffering, I would argue, is a consequence of the fall. I mean, I am an old earth creationist, but I would argue, as Bill Dembski does, that you can have a fall that's retroactive with respect to its cause and effect relationship. So outside the Garden of Eden, so Adam and Eve fall at a defined point in time. Outside of the Garden of Eden, they are then expelled to, and that world is being prepared in anticipation for the fall. So that's my position on theodicy, and Scripture says that it's not just it's all of creation that has been subjected to this frustration, as Romans 8 puts it, that we're in the world is cursed, and that we live in a fallen world as a consequence of our sin and our rebellion against a holy and just God.
We are going to have to start to wrap things up. We've opened up a whole theological tin of worms right in the last five minutes of the program, which we maybe have to come back and dissect again at some point in the future, Corey, because it sounds like the real deal for you is not intelligent design, it's suffering. That's the real issue that seems to be coming across. Maybe we'll get the chance to do that another time. For the moment, Corey, been really good to have you on, and all the very best as you continue in your endeavors. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation.
Oh, I really have. And again, I'm so honored to be on the show. Thank you, Jonathan, for speaking with me.
Thank you.
And I hope to come back on the show. And I will debate whatever okay. I would love to come back and talk about evil and suffering.
If we've got any volunteers to come on with Corey, there's an open invitation there. So we'll see what we can set up at some point down the line. Jonathan, thanks for being with me again.
Thank you, Justin. It's great to meet you, Corey.
If you want to find out more about Corey, check out atheistrepublic.com. Where can people find out more information on what you do, Jonathan?
They can go to crossexamined.org, or they can go to the Christian Apologetics Alliance. I'm also a blogger, Evolution News and Views, or they can add me on Facebook and Twitter.
Great. And all the links and more available from the website of the program, of course, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. We're looking forward to hearing some of your responses to recent programs. For the moment, it's thanks to my guests today, Jonathan and Corey, and we hope you enjoyed today's show.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
If you want to get in touch about anything you heard on today's show, you're more than welcome to drop me a line. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also, of course, find us on Facebook and Twitter. Follow me at UnbelievableJB or on Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. Leave your thoughts that way. Thanks, Jennifer, who got in touch on Facebook to say thank you so much, Justin, for the series Unbelievable. I listen every week. It's so important for me to have thinking Christians. I can't thank you enough. Please keep it up. Podcasts are fantastic. I've been listening every night right back to 2008. Terrific. So good to hear learned professors of philosophy, science and mathematics who are Christians speaking with such wisdom, especially as most of my family are atheists. So it gives me much encouragement. Thanks again for your enthusiasm in producing these programs, Justin. They're invaluable. Jennifer, thank you so much for getting in touch via Facebook to let me know that you're enjoying the program. Of course, loads of atheists also get in touch with me every week. Here's Taylor, an atheist out in Texas, who says, thanks for another interesting episode on the resurrection last week. I was unimpressed with Tony Costa. How does a theologian repeatedly press his opponent on the significance of the apostolic belief in resurrection, even going so far as to suggest it was expected the resurrection would happen at the end of time, and yet fail to mention Paul's references to Jesus as the first fruits of the resurrection, particularly in 1 Corinthians 15. Apocalyptic expectations are numerous in Paul's writing, and the theme of the delay of the parousia is well known in and Gospel Studies. It struck me as a gross oversight. Another example is Mr. Costa's claim about the surprising presence of women at the empty tomb right after he'd gotten through saying that Mark emphasises irony in his Gospel. If this irony was a literary device to draw the attention of the hearers and readers of the narrative, the historicity of the woman at the tomb becomes as questionable as other instances of ironic exaggeration in Mark. As I pointed out on the episode with Gary Habermas, we once again got no discussion of the statistical method used to single out the minimal facts too. Enjoyable as the later show was, it felt rather unnecessary and lackluster compared to the previous one. Interesting points you're raising there, Taylor. As regards the apocalyptic expectations of Paul and so on and the delay of the parousia, I don't see exactly what significance that has to the evidence for the resurrection itself. Yes, I mean, Paul was, it looks like, often in his writings, expecting an imminent return of Christ, and that Christ's resurrection was the first fruits of that. But the fact that he may have been wrong about that, 2,000 years later, does that invalidate the fact that he did see Christ as the first fruits of a resurrection, whether it be imminent or in the longer term? Maybe you need to send me a bit more detail on that so I can understand you correctly. Jeff in Canada says, first time responder, long time listener, compliments on the amazing job you do. It's refreshing to have a platform for open discussions. The revisiting the resurrection episode was interesting. I thought it could have been developed deeper in support of the evidence for its plausibility. I've recently been following the podcast of ex-cold case investigator J. Warner Wallace, who's presented a very interesting method of addressing the very issue of the evidence in support of the plausibility of the resurrection. He does so by applying investigative methods used in criminology today. He may be a good guest to get on the program in the future. Well, if you do check back, actually, Jeff, in the podcast archives a couple of years ago now, we did in fact have J. Warner Wallace on in the past. Thank you very much for getting in touch. James says, listening to the episode on the resurrection, I thought I'd bring up a comparable event. Between live television coverage, cell phone footage and security cameras, the 9/11 attacks are probably some of the best documented spontaneous public events in recent memory. Yet, within hours of this recorded event, massive, complex, alternate stories emerged and are maintained to this day. Seems to me if modern people with instant access to multiple sources can believe and spread earnestly misinformation, why does it seem improbable that ancient people from a largely superstitious illiterate society might believe and spread stories that are not true? Says James. And Dave in Litchfield. Now, Dave is the sort of person who said they were trying to find their way into the Christian faith, having not been a believer before or come from a different faith tradition. And emails again this week to say, I must admit, since leaving another faith tradition, I'm at a bit of a loss as to where I stand theologically. However, I was more convinced by the evidence of the resurrection because of Ed's inability to adequately explain his arguments against the resurrection. Even someone as sceptical as Bart Ehrman would agree that Paul's authorship of 1 Corinthians 15 is not in any dispute. In fact, I believe 1 Corinthians was written around the mid-50s AD, making it a very early and authentic source text. I believe this chapter contains the earliest recounting of the resurrection. There are two things that are of note. Firstly, if the resurrection of Jesus is a myth, then it's a very unusual myth, since the story has not changed nor has it developed in any way since the beginning. Secondly, the material reads very honestly. Paul clearly believes what he's saying. It's important that we don't indulge in notions of modern superiority. People in the first century knew just as well as we do now that when people died, they stayed dead. When Jesus suggested Jairus' daughter was merely sleeping, they mocked him to scorn. The raising of Lazarus, even Jesus' followers didn't believe that Jesus could raise Lazarus because he had died 3 days ago. In other words, he was properly dead. So, people in the first century knew that death was a permanent thing. So when people from the time insist that Jesus was raised from the dead to the point of laying down their lives, when Paul stops persecuting Christians and joins them on account of meeting Christ, when the tomb is found empty and nobody is ever found or accounted for, I think we can at least consider the possibility of the resurrection. Lovely to hear from you, Dave. I hope that you'll continue in the journey you're evidently on. Paul in Belfast greatly enjoyed the discussion. On the issue of the empty tomb, I thought Tony did a great job, but due to the nature of the dialogue and time constraints, there were a few things that were missed. Ed says the creed of 1 Corinthians 15 mentions nothing about an empty tomb. However, that fails on account of the statement, he was raised the third day. Why the third day? It seems that the only reason the third day would be significant is that it was the day his tomb was discovered empty. Also, even if the story of the guard in Matthew were an invention, Why would it be invented? It would be invented as a response to the charge that the disciples stole the body from the tomb. Another point, if Matthew did invent the story of the guard, then it was a bit silly of him not to have the guard placed at the tomb right from the moment of the burial. There's a window of opportunity in the story for the tomb to be raided before the guards come. There's no reason why Matthew would record this except that it actually happened that way. Finally, it seems that the only thing Ed had to say about Joseph of Arimathea was that he's a strange character. Well, that's true, and he certainly isn't the kind of character the Christians would have invented to give Jesus an honourable burial. The burial narrative show the disciples in a very poor light and have a member of the hated Sanhedrin as the hero. For these reasons and others that Tony gave, it seems the empty tomb is rock solid historically, no pun intended. And you also recommend Frank Turek as a good person to bring on the show at some point. Thanks, Paul, out in Belfast. And here's Josh from Oxford. Hope you're well, and the newborn also. I was listening to the show. I'm a member, actually, of Ed's discussion group and gave the case in a 10-minute talk from the Christian side for the resurrection when we last discussed it and then was subject to a Q&A. Couple of thoughts on the show. Firstly, I loved hearing Ed's own views on things. In the discussion group, he was only able to moderate rather than bring out his own thoughts. Second, not at all convinced by a hallucination hypothesis. I think that Ed can offer individual bits here and there, but the explanation becomes more and more ad hoc and implausible to explain why they believe, firstly, resurrection and not ascension, why they accepted a crucified Messiah, the numerous appearances, the multiple attestations, the conversion of skeptics, why people embraced persecution, the prophecies of resurrection, and so on. You say you're also of the opinion of Tim McGrew that I'm not content with merely a minimal facts hypothesis, but would prefer to go for a maximal facts hypothesis, embracing the fullness of the gospel evident. And fourthly, there's always a bit of confusion in the word minimal. Gary Habermas uses these in different ways to Tony, Costa and William Lane Craig. Habermas was quite clear that the empty tomb is not a minimal fact for him when he was on the show. Anyway, thank you very much and congratulations as you recently won the Tyndale Philosophy of Religion Prize, which was advertised on the Unbelievable page. That's brilliant. Well done, Josh, and perhaps we can get you on to talk about that at some point. We're out of time for the moment, though, and I've had so many more emails on this, especially Stephen, who got in touch with via Facebook and email with quite a long, and I will try and read this out next week, sort of response to the hallucination theory that Ed Atkinson brought up in that resurrection debate last week. So we'll come to that and hopefully some more next week at the same time. For the moment, thanks for joining me here on the programme that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon and online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And come back again at the same time next week for the next discussion.
You're unbelievable.
It's a theological debate next week between a Calvinist, that's someone who believes that God, if you like, is sovereignly in control of everything that happens in people's lives, and someone who doesn't take that view, takes what's called the warfare view, particularly of suffering. Kurt Jaros takes that view, and he's going to be in discussion with a Calvinist scholar, Ken Brownell, next week, as they look at suffering from the so-called warfare view and the more Calvinist view of suffering. So come back for that at the same time next week. It dovetails nicely with how our current show ended, obviously, and Corey's concerns over the problem of suffering and so on. So if you're able to come back, I look forward to you joining me then. For the moment, have a great week, and we'll see you next time.